Hello, welcome to this holiday week edition of the Bearcats Blogcast. My name is Scott, joined by Chris Baines. How's it going, Chris?
Pretty good, Scott. It's been a pretty good week. Yeah, like you said, this is the holiday week, so this is going to be like a shortened version. Under an hour, you and I have stuff to do, somewhat related to holidays, maybe not related to holidays, but this is going to be a pretty brief Bearcats Blogcast.
Probably to the joy of the one person who listens to this podcast every week.
Hey, my mom loves listening to our podcast, so I don't know what you're talking about. We're going to kick things off with National Signing Day. This year, starting this cycle, there's technically two national signing periods. Same kind of situation like in basketball. In hoops, there's an early national signing period where some players who are basically, 100% committed to schools, not wavering, they can sign early. And then there's another signing period in the spring, I think around April, for hoops. Football is implementing something similar this year where National Signing Day is in December for a couple of days starting this year on the 20th, so yesterday. And then there's the normal national signing period the first week of February. UC pretty much signed everybody in their class. They had 21 commitments, 20 of them signed. The only one who hasn't is Chauncey Manick, the former Georgia linebacker who projects to some kind of probably lineman at UC, Garden City Community College. He spent a year there. Unfortunately, it sounds like he's going through some academic issues, which isn't super shocking for a JUCO player, but he is the only one who hasn't signed. Among the signees are pretty much your regular bunch of players who we expected to sign: Josh Wiley, Malik Van, Arquan Bush, Ben Bryant, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The class is ranked 46th in the country by 24/7 Sports, number one in the conference by leaps and bounds. They're currently ranked ahead of the likes of Stanford and Texas Tech and several Power Five schools, Arizona State. I mean, Arizona State's a unique thing because they've got Herm Edwards now, and he's going to stink it up on the recruiting trail. But overall, I mean, Fickell got what he got, pretty much did with his class what he set out to do. Signed an excellently well-ranked class full of Ohio kids. I think I saw a tweet out there that among the top 50 Ohio recruits out there, UC signed 7 of them, which is tied for first with Michigan State. So Fickell essentially top to bottom accomplished everything he wanted to do in this class. Not many other holes to fill. Scott, thoughts?
Yeah, the main thing that jumps out is they signed, like you said, they signed pretty much everybody, which I know there's some worry with the AAC schools and the smaller schools that your name brand universities really trying to get some people to wait until the later signing period to see how their scholarship situation shakes out. I know Malik Van, he said a week ago that he was going to go to UC. But I guess there was still some hand-wringing if he was going to wait for Ohio State. So it's good that he signed on and everybody else signed on. So it's pretty exciting in that sense. We know who the Bearcats are going to be, and I guess the coaching staff still has some time to see what's out there after the roster breaks down, after the college football season eventually comes to an end. We get all the transfers and all that stuff settled.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's a good point. I mean, there weren't really any surprises. I mean, the only surprise we saw was Michi Harris, former Kentucky commitment. He decommitted pretty much following his official visit at UC, and he was a guy who UC had been on since the very beginning and just spurned us for Kentucky. I mean, that's not too surprised. Kentucky under Stoops has done really, really well in Ohio, and Harris is one of those players that they have been getting for the last few years. But Fickell turned up, pulled out all the stops to go get him. He knew the talent Michi Harris was. He knew that there was a huge deficiency at UC in terms of the wide receiver position. This is a guy who's going to come in and
probably play significantly from day one. He's just that kind of impact player. And it was really encouraging on top of getting guys like Josh Wiley, who's going to be a split-out tight end wide receiver at 6'6", 233. You got Ben Bryant, a potential quarterback of the future. You've got a running back staple in Ryan Montgomery coming in from Franklin. You got Javon Hicks, who can play safety wide receiver. He saw deficiencies in several areas and went out and got them. In other areas, the defensive line, you got Malik Van, who could potentially start a defensive tackle. You got Arquan Bush, who could be a starter at the cornerback position. You got Deshaun Martin, who could be a starter along the line at end. Ty Van Fossen could be an impact linebacker down the road. Blake Basevich from St. Xavier could be a good impact lineman. I mean, in terms of areas where he saw deficiencies, he filled those holes in terms of areas where he saw potential to add more talent and improve that position. Like, UC was excellent on the defensive line last year, but he basically added to those strengths. I mean, I don't really see any major areas here where there's major misses. I mean, maybe you could add another offensive lineman, which they could get in the next few scholarship spots between now and February. Who knows? But, I mean, up and down the list, he signed basically, what, 4 or 5 receivers plus tight ends? Like he went out and got exactly what he needed, and it's really encouraging to see.
Yeah, 4 receivers, 2 tight ends, just on the UC like signee list, which has to be the whatever UC turned in. So yeah, like it's like really good to see like they went after the areas they really needed. Although I guess you could say offensive line, they only signed 2 offensive linemen. And with how big a problem that was this year, and was last year under the old regime, you still have the JUCO ranks to fill out some of these things, and stuff always shakes down, because not all these guys will end up on campus, because we know how recruiting works. It's hopefully everybody comes in and you get a lot of guys that can step in and make an impact, especially with the receivers, because. There's going to be definitely one spot where Gray leaves. So yep. You have another guy competing for a starting spot. And a lot of the guys this year really, some of them had nice seasons, but it's going to be a lot of competition. And there's a definite chance for some of these guys to step in and get big playing time. Especially Wiley at tight end, because that position's wide open with Cogswell leaving. He can step in and be, you would think he could be an immediate 4-year player. Or 4-year starter and contributor, I mean.
Well, especially with his frame of 6'6", 6'7", 233, I wouldn't be surprised if he plays along the line, I split out wide, you put him in goal line situations, you put him in fade routes where he can basically outleap a 5'10 cornerback. I mean, Wiley's the type of player that is a game changer in the passing game. He's the guy. He's UC hasn't had a go-to receiver since Chris Moore, Shaq Washington. I mean, that feels like lifetimes ago. Bringing a guy like Wiley, to come in and be that height advantage over smaller cornerbacks and the speed advantage over linebackers. I mean, he's a guy you can get first downs and muscle his way into that position. That's the type of athlete that I'm encouraged that Fickell prioritized to grab.
He's definitely their highest profile recruit. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one thing we should probably make about the offensive line, they only signed 2 offensive linemen, but and I definitely saw that, and I probably should correct myself then, but Dylan O'Quinn, he's the tight end, but he's a blocking tight end. And he's currently at 6'5", 255. UC lists him at 270 currently. So he's definitely a guy who could probably slide in and play along the offensive line. Lawrence Metz, the German, 6'9", 280. The guy plays defensive line. You look at his tape and, he looks like a giant out there playing lower level high school football. But he's definitely got the framework to be an offensive lineman. So technically they signed only 2 pure offensive linemen who actually played that in high school, but you have 2 others there who could potentially slide in and fill that role. So yeah, it's probably something I wish they would have signed a third pure offensive lineman, but like to your point, I mean, there's the JUCO ranks for that. You can potentially grab a Nick Lewis, who UC was in on, who is committed to Washington State and who's out of the JUCO ranks. There's others out there as well. So I think that was definitely their biggest need in this class was offensive linemen. I think they pretty much accomplished that as long as guys like O'Quinn and Metz, you know, pan out.
Yeah, that's a very good point. As we see that stuff happen all the time with guys getting moved to offensive line or getting moved to defensive line. Back and forth. So That's something I really didn't account for, obviously. Is there anything that kind of like worried you about this class? Like something that you wanted to see them address that they didn't address? Or are you like feeling pretty good about it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is like, I feel like, I mean, they definitely nabbed the receivers. They got speed and size on the outside. They got Wiley, they've got Harris, they've got potentially Javon Hicks if he's probably going to play safety, but I mean if he doesn't, you got him potentially to play on the outside. Alex Pierce is expected to be, I mean, lower, small, like less recruited player, mainly MAC schools, but he apparently has like a 4.440 at a 6.3 height. Like the kid is a flash out there on the outside. That was my concern going into the class was offensive linemen and speed of the receiver position, because they just did not have talent at either position this past year. And I think for the most part, they went out and grabbed it. Again, I maybe would have liked to see them grab one more pure offensive lineman who has real experience along the line, because like the offensive line position is pretty complicated to play. You don't really see someone elevated to a starter until they've kind of spent a little bit of time in the system, because it's one of those positions where you have to communicate in an instant on who's blocking who, and then you have to actually go out there and block them every single play and make snaps on the fly. I mean, they say the center is the quarterback of the offensive line position because he really is, but then the other four guys there have to actually communicate and understand what the others are doing, so they know who to block and when to block them and when to slide and protect and all that kind of stuff. It's really complicated to play. And that's why I like the fact that they signed two guys who could potentially play that position later on. I kind of wanted them to see that they added a third pure offensive lineman who has experience there. But I mean, you're nitpicking the class at that point. I mean, for the most part, this is an excellent class, fill several holes in several positions with guys who could potentially play from day one. And yeah, I mean, if we're talking about giving grades on Fickell's performance this year, I mean, who knows? Coaching standpoint, you can have a lot of debate on whether or not he did a good job A, B, or C, but I think he gets an A+ in terms of this recruiting class. I mean, he did an excellent job.
Yeah, definitely. Like one of the things that everybody banked on when they hired Fickell was that he'd be able to lock down Ohio, and he even said that as much as in his introductory press conference. That's exactly what he's done with his first big recruiting class, like 11 guys from Ohio. The top player in the class, but another highly thought of player in Van, like a lot of potential like going on here, and a top 50 class at UC is not easy to do, because we haven't seen that done really in a long time.
Yeah, and that's the thing is like, yeah, like over the Butch Jones era, that was probably the only time where, and Jones was an excellent recruiter at UC, but he never, even with playing under a Big East flag, I don't think he ever really got UC over like the 60 mark, maybe in the 50s. I mean, shit, never 46th while basically playing in second tier conferences, you know, like the job that Fickell did so far. And, you know, obviously this is the first signing day, you know, everything gets locked in after February, but he's already got UC up to 46th and he's got a few more spots to fill. I mean, even if he finishes in the 50s, I mean, that's still an excellent job.
Yeah, absolutely. Just where they are now, like, is pretty much ideal. Because, like, one of the things we talked about, it seems like, since we started the podcast, was how UC really just needed to focus, like, on Ohio first and get Ohio kids to come to UC. And that's exactly what's happened. Like, if this was what you were looking for in the Luke Fickell hire, like, you got it. And like it seems like the program is like headed, at least like talent wise, they're headed in a really good direction. Because they're not just first in the league, like in by the 24/7 metric, they're first like by a comfortable margin. It's like all the guys he locked down were rated 3 stars, which I mean, star ratings like I guess don't really matter if they're not 5-star recruits. But hey, it's still pretty awesome. Like 21 signings, 20 of them are 3 stars. Like that just like normally doesn't happen at UC. Doesn't happen in this league, period.
Exactly. Like you normally see like, well, you're right. The star ratings don't matter because at the beginning of the season, Malik Van and Josh Wiley were both 4-star recruits that for some reason the rankers decided to drop them down to high 3 stars. But traditionally, you see in this league, the better teams, like the ones who've recruited better, like the South Floridas, the Houstons, the typical makeup is a couple of 4 stars, a few 3 stars, some 2 stars. And then as you're getting down to like the middle and the lower end of like the AAC, it's like mainly 2 and 3 stars. Which, you know, if you go start going down to, like, the UConn level or the ECU level, like, a lot more 2 stars or unranked players than anything. I mean, unfortunately, that's kind of what we saw here under the later end of the Tuberville era, but it's nice to see, just from a rating standpoint and a scholarship comparison standpoint, you know, Wiley had offers from Oregon. Malik Van had interest from Ohio State and turned down offers from Clemson. Like, those are the types of players that Fickell's coming in and getting, in which he's convincing them to stay and play at UC rather than go elsewhere. And he's convincing them to stay at UC and play in the AAC conference. Like, you're barely even competing for major bowl spots, let alone national championships. I mean, maybe eventually, but I mean, it's the guy can sell freaking ice to an Eskimo. I mean, Jesus.
Yeah, he's been really great. And it doesn't even matter if UC falls down the rankings some. Which, like, I guess there's still a chance they can, because, like, UCF only has 14 guys signed for their class, and who knows how they'll finish with their new coaching staff. And, like, SMU has 20 guys still. Like, you wonder how, like, some of their new hires will, like, invigorate their recruits, or if their ratings will go down. I think the one thing that's worrisome for the league as a whole is kind of what you mentioned. Like, no 5 stars, no 4 stars in the entire league in this early signing period. Like, the difference between, like, the Power 5 leagues and the Group of 5 leagues is, like, really stark when it comes to that. And
right.
If you're going to compete with those types of teams, like, that's what you have. You have to get, the big-name recruits. Even if, like, you have, like, the Wileys and Vans who get, like, dropped down. But, like, getting that one big player, like, at Oliver, that's, like, a program changer. Because, like, as long as he's at Houston, like, they're going to be competitive. And they'll be, like, this was a down year for them. And they still won, like 7 or 8 games with the bowl game still to play. And they'll be right near the favorites to win the league next year because they have, like, a transformational player on their roster.
Right.
Which is really hard to get. And I think we've seen even more is, like, the Group of Five has been established that it's getting harder to get some of those like really like upper level recruits to sign because you have like the best team in the whole Group of Five era. They didn't even get close to playing for a playoff berth. They barely end up in the top 10. It's like, that's the kind of uphill battle you're looking at. And like, maybe it like sustained success for somebody or getting in on the ground floor, like with, like, maybe a big Ohio recruit, like, who ends up being a 5-star. Like, maybe, like, that's how you land somebody that big. But it's, like, a definite cause for concern for the league, I think.
It is, and it's unfortunately, it's not something that's just going to, like, change overnight. Like, the only way that the Group of Five could, or the AAC in particular, screw the rest of the Group of Five, the only way the AAC is going to really break that trend is by either, you know, consistently putting up undefeated seasons from one of their teams, which is a mountain, or somehow the college football playoff expands to eight teams, and or 8 spots, and one of those spots goes to the Group of Five highest ranked team, which more often than not would be the AAC, in which case you could sell that to recruits a little better than what they have now. But I mean, I don't know. Other than that, I mean, if UC is still in the AAC and then the American in general continues to kind of be that middle league between the Group of Five and the Power Five, I don't know if that would necessarily be that bad, considering that if you're looking at some of these rankings, like UC is 46th, South Florida is 54th, the next team is Boise State down to 61. Houston's there kind of near in the top six in the 64th. You see Dabbling's here, Tulane's there. I mean, for the most part, this conference is out recruiting the rest of the Group of Five, which for the time being is kind of like, that's kind of, as long as those expectations are met, I think that's going to be the best we can hope for, which isn't all that bad, you know, in the long term.
And the other biggest, like, long-term problem is, like, if Luke Fickell brings in a great class this year, then starts to do it next year, like, who knows? If the team turns around, like, who knows if he'll even be around for another stab at things.
Oh, no. The worst part, the darkest timeline is if he signs this recruiting class, signs another recruiting class, and then wins, like, six total games over the next 2 years. that would be the darkest timeline.
that would not be great. Do you have anything else about signing day, or are you ready to move on to basketball?
No, I think I'm good. I think it's interesting as we kind of close that segment out is the fact that I think, you know, last week in the podcast we talked about, you know, we don't really know how many recruits are going to sign. It's early signing day. You'd hope that they get like 7 to 8 signing now and then the rest in February. But for the most part, across college football, you had signees in the range of about 80 to 90% of classes. I mean, UC had 20 to 21 commitments signed yesterday. That tells me that like the signing day is now in December, and then the one in February is just like your secondary one. I think that's just kind of interesting how that dynamic has shifted just in the first season of adding that early national signing day. And you know, for better or worse, UC not going to a bowl game definitely helped them here with early signing day. I mean, I think it helped them get Michi Harris. I mean, Joker Phillips, a wide receiver coach, was able to actually go make an in-home visit and see one of his basketball games here in the last few weeks, whereas I don't think Kentucky could do that because they're going to a bowl game. You know, unfortunately, not going to a bowl game this year really freed up the coaching staff's ability to focus 100% on the recruiting class, which I find kind of interesting. I mean, as you look at that dynamic going forward, it's almost like if you're rebuilding, you're better off not going 6-6. You're better off going like 4-8 like UC did.
That's a really good point, actually, especially for this league, the AAC, where like so many of the bowl games are being played right around this time. The SMU played last night. It's like their coaching staff had to like focus on actually being a coaching staff,
right?
While their new coaching staff, like I guess their situation was a bit different because their new coaching staff could recruit, and their current coaches could focus on the bowl game. Like Temple is like in a weird spot where they had to do both, and they have a game today. It's just weird because like your games are so early, and like you have to really like kind of split both things. Like even South Florida, their bowl game is this weekend. It's like just a busy week for their coaches. Like how you prioritize that is got to be really tough.
Yeah, and it's like I mean. Assuming UC goes to a bowl game next year, I'd be curious what happens to this class, to next year's class. I wonder if any of the, you know, Fickell has a mentality of building a family with each class. So, you know, as you're adding to that family, kids get tight knit. They text each other. They're all, you know, coming to campus at the same time on visits to hang out. So it creates a dynamic where it's harder to pluck players out of that class. Unless, you know, the staff essentially says, hey, we're over-recruiting you, Feel free to look at other options, which, I mean, for better or worse, that happens a lot. Every program does it. But I'd be curious if UC goes to a, you know, a decent bowl game next year, you know, finishes, you know, 6-6, even like 8-4 or something like that, if we see potentially more players decommitting on National Signing Day than we had this year, which was exactly zero. And they actually picked up a commitment from Kentucky to sign with UC. So interesting. I think it's an interesting dynamic going forward because, back when the National Signing Day was in February, coaches essentially got done with recruit or got done prepping for bowls, and then it was like 100% on the recruiting trail. This year and going forward, coaches are going to have to split time. I'm curious how they've managed that.
Just from the looks of some of the teams in bowl games, it seems like they focus more on recruiting than some of the bowls.
SMU in particular.
Yeah, that was kind of brutal.
And I actually, speaking of that, I mean, when you're talking about how SMU, where they have kind of like that dual coaching staff going on right now, I mean, Central Florida has Auburn here on New Year's Day. Really curious how that works out with Scott Frost coaching the game, and then Missouri's ex-offensive coordinator, actually working the recruiting trail. So not really sure how that's going to work out.
Yeah, that's going to be something interesting to watch, especially since we know like how hard he's been recruiting for Nebraska. I just took a look at SMU's like recruits. Like they have a 20-person class, but they only were able to get 7 players to sign yesterday, which is a pretty big deal. I guess there's a lot of waiting to see with Sonny Dykes and what his staff does with their scholarships. That we didn't talk about that. How did you feel about that hire?
Oh, I love me some Sonny Dykes. Oh, Sonny Dykes is excellent. I feel like Sonny Dykes got he was a bit of a weird fit at Cal. I mean, he's a guy who has most of his prowess coming from the Southeast or like the Texas region. And then he was transplanted to Cal, where it was kind of like a fish out of water situation. But I mean, he did a great job with Louisiana Tech. He did an excellent job at TCU. He was only an offensive analyst, but I mean, he was involved in that offense. He's a good coach, and I think he'll fit in perfectly at SMU. I think that was like the perfect hire they could have grabbed.
I guess if you're SMU, you hope it doesn't go like it did last night for the rest of his game.
Right. Exactly.
I guess that's the people wonder why coaches don't just jump in and coach the bowl game. I guess that's exhibit A, why that doesn't happen.
That's right. Yeah, because I mean his coaching record in 2017 is now is 0 wins. and that's never going to change.
And one humiliating defeat,
right? So, but I mean, overall, I think long term, I think that's a perfect hire. I think he's going to do great work down at SMU.
I like that one too, especially somebody who knows the Texas area and like recruited Texas pretty well when he was at Cal. I think that's a good hire for them, and it just adds on to like the list of like rehabilitated coaches who are getting chances in this league. Like Charlie Strong, who got fired, then got hired by USF. Now Sonny Dykes, like he wasn't a coach this year. Like as you mentioned, he was an analyst, and like now he catches on at SMU. So now we're seeing like a couple of different like tactics. I guess Randy Itzel last year being another big example. But now different tactics of like some schools going for like the fresh new face, other schools going for like the retread coach, like the coach looking for a bounce back.
Yeah, and that's kind of what's interesting. I mean, like, Sonny Dykes, if he does well at SMU, he's getting paid good money, he's got a good recruiting budget, he's in Texas, so he knows everything about every school probably down there. If he does well there, he could pivot that to maybe potentially a Texas Tech role if Ryan Gosling over there gets fired sometime down the road, or, I don't know, Texas A&M, if the Jimbo Fisher experiment doesn't work out. I mean, who knows? I mean, he's... Like we kind of talked about last week, or I don't know, a couple of podcasts ago, you know, coaches coming to this conference can see it as a jumping off point to high tier Power 5 gigs. I mean, if Sonny Dykes has the grand plan of coaching in the SEC or the Big 12 one day, I mean, SMU's the place to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think that, because if you can win there, like, it's a good job and people really look for, like, the coaches that can recruit certain states, like Florida and Texas and Ohio. So if, like, Luke Fickell does well, like, next year, which I guess we're all hoping he does, obviously, since we're Cincinnati fans on a Cincinnati podcast, like, his name's definitely going to get thrown out there. And, like, what happened yesterday, the success of that is a reason why.
Yep, exactly. So, you know, good. I think from just a micro standpoint, our class, excellent. I think UC is going to look good going forward from a talent standpoint. I think probably by about 2019, that season will pretty much have flushed all of the, not to say, you know, poorly talented Tuberville recruits out of the system and have Fickell's, you know, recruits all over the place. But I mean, that's pretty much going to be the case. I think he's elevating the talent level on this team. And it's really encouraging to see. I mean, hopefully he can turn that into more wins than last season. But I mean, then on like a more macro level, I mean, the AAC continues to outplay and now out-recruit the rest of the G5, separating themselves there. So that's also encouraging.
One, like 100%. Like, it's really, like, they can talk about like being like the Power 6. Like, you have to show it. And, like, I think they've been showing it, at least on the recruiting surface, not so much in their early bowl games.
Yeah, exactly. So, moving on to hoops. Not much goes on this week. I don't know, Scott, do you have anything to talk about with the Arkansas Pine Bluff game?
Nobody got injured.
Pretty much. I think we were talking before the podcast that we both picked up this game, like, maybe about halfway through and via Twitter, and didn't watch a single minute of the game. So bad on us, I guess. But we can talk about UCLA. I know you watched that game, Scott.
Yeah, like that Pine Bluff game, I don't know what happened. Normally I'm good at like memorizing the schedule. That one just completely slipped to my mind because it wasn't on TV, and like it not being on TV in the middle of December is really frustrating. I don't care if you're playing Pine Bluff. Make some deal with somebody. I don't know how that would work, but make it happen somehow. Like, rewinding back to UCLA, like, we talked about how big that stretch was of those four marquee teams in the non-conference, because it's, like, right back to garbage with playing Cleveland State tonight. Like, UC did go 2-2 with a couple of nice wins over maybe potential tournament teams. Like, mm-hmm. UCLA still has time to recover. And, like, that win was, like, just pretty much dominating. Like, UC went on that gigantic run at the end of the half, like, what, a 15-point run, and really put the game away. And I think it was probably their best, like, overall performance of the season, despite, like, letting UCLA come back. But they were up so big in the second half. That's kind of bound to happen. And they still won by 14. Just a really great outing and showed off a lot of the positives that can still happen with this team. And of course, like, they turn around and like play Pine Bluff and then like have 15 turnovers. Like, this team is kind of like, I don't know. It's like they showed like signs of being like a team that can go get big wins on the road. And then the team that can be like kind of stagnant on offense. Like, I don't know. This team is like, I kind of wish they were a little better than they have shown right now.
Yeah, that run at the end of the half, I mean, they were tied at 18 with UCLA at the second to last TV timeout, and then went on an 18-5 run that involved not just offense. I mean, obviously they got threes from Kane Broome, Kyle Washington, and Jacob Evans. But the defense, I mean, the defense just clamped down and created turnover after turnover that UC turned into points. I mean, we were kind of talking about this season that we knew the defense was going to be excellent, but could they actually have the offense to pivot off of that?
I mean, they proved it in those last two segments, and then that just carried them on to victory. I mean, and to your point, I mean, that's a road win. I mean, you don't go into UCLA and just comfortably beat the Bruins. I mean, this isn't the team they were last year, obviously, without Lonzo Ball at the point. I mean, few teams would be, but that's still a good, potentially tournament team, and you did it on the road, and you did it in pretty much dominant fashion after, like, the eight-minute mark in the first half.
With the CBS A-team there, like, being the only national right. game, especially with the emphasis on road games this season, road games and neutral site games, like, that was a big win, because like, their biggest road neutral site win was, like, Wyoming, Buffalo. Nothing really stood out, and that was a nice one to get. And could you imagine the turnovers? Like, they forced 18. They forced 22 in the last game. Like, the defense is, like, elite. I kind of wondered at the beginning of the year if it would drop down a little just because you lose, like, your two guards. The answer was no, because they have Gary Clark is, like, making a case for National Defensive Player of the Year. Like, he's just been ridiculous. And, like, any defense that's circled around him is going to be great. Like, he's going to be somebody... Like, we're going to miss Gary Clark because he's awesome. But they're going to miss Gary Clark just being the anchor of the team next year. He's, like, had such a great senior season. It's really been... it's been fun to watch. Watch him really, like, blossom into the player we all wanted him to be.
Yeah, he had an excellent game at UCLA. I mean, obviously, Gary Clark, every single game, no matter who the opponent, he's going to give you the intangibles. He's going to give you the presence down low to make every shot that an opposing power forward or cutting guard a difficult one. But, I mean, overall, he put up the numbers as well. I mean, he went 11. He had 11 boards, 10 points, you know, a double-double for him. And then he got contributions from everybody, pretty much. I mean, the only one who really didn't give a solid contribution offensively was Justin Jennifer, but Kane Broome picked him up. I mean, between the two of them, they had 16 points. They were almost perfect from the free throw line. Between the two of them, 9 of 10 from the free throw line, which, I mean, UC as a team was still struggling, but, I mean, I don't know. That's just a Mick Cronin era problem, and all of those are dragged down by Cumberland.
Yeah,
but,
I was about to say.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're going to get that. But, I mean, he still even finished with 10 points. Jacob Evans has had 16 points. He was 4 of 6 from 3. Kyle Washington had 19 points. He led all the Bearcats with points. I mean, that was the most balanced, dominant win on both sides of the floor, and it didn't come against, like Arkansas Pine Bluff. Like, they arguably played better against UCLA than they did against Arkansas Pine Bluff. I mean, again, you and I didn't watch that game. We were just looking at the box score. But there was some dropping off in the second half in terms of performance against Arkansas Pine Bluff. A lot of that's probably the fact that Mick played a lot of the backups, like Keith Williams and Trevor Moore. But I mean, not all 40 minutes, but like pretty much from that second to last TV timeout in the first half. I mean, UC played an incredibly complete game on both sides of the floor from all of their starters.
Yeah, definitely. And it's the kind of effort it's going to take to win on the road in this league. Because you get a pretty tough test right away with Temple on the road. A team that's like been pretty solid all season. And if like you like take them lightly, you could definitely get knocked down against Temple. It's like that was encouraging. And like the Pine Bluff you can like kind of write off, definitely, because they played a weird lineup. Like Jacob Evans played 15 second half minutes, and they used the only starter to get really a lot of run in the second half. Cumberland didn't even play the second half of that game. it's the type of game like where they let the bench go and the bench turned it over like 7 times.
I mean that. I almost look at that as like a throwaway game. Like,
oh, it definitely was.
I mean, all you do is look at the final score. I mean, like, I don't care about stat lines. Like, I care about stat lines against the Arkansas Pine Bluff if that's like game one or two of the season, but not like game 12. Like, Mick is just basically he's just giving his backups a little bit more experience before they head into the meat of AAC play, which I'm fine with. I mean, that's perfectly fine.
Because you're not going to be in situations, like, no matter what happens, where, like, Mamadou Diarra is playing 12 minutes a game.
Right. Hopefully not.
Yeah, unless they get really, like, savaged by injury. But, yeah, like, that game and this game tonight against Cleveland State are just games to make money for the program. And get some of these guys some minutes, get them some run. Just pretty important because if somebody gets injured, they're going to have to play. Like, probably not Diarra, but like your Trey Scotts and your Trevor Moores and your Keith Williams. And like most of those guys have pretty solid games too.
Yeah, you have to hope that, you know, going into conference play, if anyone gets hurt, and I mean if you have to, I mean not if, injury whatever, if you have to lose anybody throughout the course of the season, you kind of feel more comfortable losing like a Jacob Evans or Jerron Cumberland, I think, than you would like a Gary Clark or a Kyle Washington, just because Keith Williams and Trevor Moore have proved to be pretty viable backups. And then you also have Kane Broome who could potentially slide in and play either of those spots if you need to use them. But like we talked about last week, oof, the backups down low are like very shaky.
Yeah. If God forbid something happened to Gary Clark, like it would almost mean the season wouldn't be over, but it'd be like you'd have to really adjust expectations.
Like almost, yeah, like, I mean,
almost to the point where you'd wonder if it was a tournament team. Okay, right. That's probably too dramatic. But it would be something like that where the whole identity of the team would change. Like just playing Nicaea Brooks in for Kyle Washington is a pretty big deal with like the offensive flow in this team. And so just like imagine one of those guys starting.
Yeah, like I mean back in the day, I mean you had Coriante DeBerry coming off the bench, and that was a guy who, you know, he kind of needed to prove that he was a good third big on the team. But he did that, and then it was nice to kind of have him as a reliable backup. I think it was Octavius Ellis who was a starter at center at that point, who he would spell for times when Ellis got into the, you know, foul trouble. But between Trey Scott, Mamadou Diarra, and Elio Sosome, and Nicaea Brooks, I mean, I would almost rather have like the true freshman Sosome out there. Other than the other three. But even then, it's, like, really questionable.
Yeah, like, he didn't even attempt a shot against Pine Bluff.
Like, yeah, he barely played.
I guess that just shows you where, like, his level of, like, offensive confidence is. Those games against a team that's just so weak and so small, like, they have, like, one big guy on Pine Bluff, it appears, but they got to play, like, 10 minutes. So, like, you're not really getting a challenge. And, like, we saw Brooks throw in 7 and Scott throw in 6. And, like, Diarra even scored. It's like if somebody's not even taking a shot in that type of game. It, like, doesn't seem great for his confidence. Which is, like, fine. It's like he's got some learning to do. And just getting out there and playing is pretty important for him. And he should get some run tonight. Because I can't imagine that McCronin's going to take this game like they're playing Duke. I bet we see a lot of weird lineups in the first half. Like a lot of mixing around, because they also don't play for like over a week until they get Memphis on New Year's Eve.
That's such a good point. I wonder if he will play his starters a little longer tonight, though, just knowing that they're going to have a week and a half off. Like making sure that they play mistake-free basketball on both sides of the floor. Because I don't know. That's actually an interesting dynamic. I mean, do you think because they have the week and a half off that he plays more of the starters, or do you think it's just like he's going to treat it like APB again?
I think it off like the giant run they did to start the APB game where they're up like 28-4,
and
like
right.
Up by like 30 points at halftime. I think the starters probably won't play a ton, but I think it should be more just to get everybody mixed in.
Yeah. That makes sense. Okay. I was just curious.
But maybe like Gary Clark and Cumberland played more like 20 minutes instead of like 15 minutes.
Yeah. Honestly,
Cumberland's got to play, I think, probably like 30 minutes. He's got to do something to shoot himself out of this funk he's in. Like, I would rather he shoot, you know, 10, 12 shots against Cleveland State and shoot his way out of this slump versus him going into Memphis still ice cold. So, yeah, like, I'd get 4 of the 5 starters, like, you know, a maximum of, like, 20 minutes, but then Cumberland give him, like, his typical 30. But that's just me. I don't know what Mick has in mind. Cumberland needs to do something to get out of this funk, and I feel like shooting his way out of it is, like, the only way. Go ahead.
I think you're right about that, because, like, even that UCLA game, he did score 10 points, but it was on, what, 4 of 8 shooting, which is still pretty fine. Like, his free throws, like, oh, he was 0-5 in that game. He's 18 of 35 this year, which is, like, unbelievable for somebody with, like, his talent level. Like, he wasn't even a good free throw shooter last year, but I think he's gotten 13% worse.
Like, oh, yeah, I mean, he was 64% last year, and now he's only hitting, like, half of his shots. That's, like, I would kill for 64% if he's shooting half of his shots this year.
And, like, his percentage on twos, like, last year, 65%, one of the best in the nation, like, top 50 in the nation. And this year he's at, you know, 43%. That's not really amazing.
Yeah, he's some. I'm just gonna chalk it up to the sophomore slump you brought up last week, and I don't know. Just hope that he just shoots his way out of it at some point.
It's like splits in the three, like, big teams they played, which are UCLA, Florida, Xavier. He's like 14 threes, 18 twos, 10 free throws. And his best percentage is on threes, which is, like, great and all, but he's, like, shooting 43% from three. And his other numbers are in the 30s. It's like, it would be nice to see him get it going.
When you're shooting better from three than you are from the free throw line, that's a sign you're not in a good place in the head.
Yeah, definitely not. It's like almost to the point where I kind of wonder if, like, maybe Kane Broome or Jennifer, if they were a couple inches taller, that Mick would start both of them and Cumberland would come off the bench. But, like, now that Broome started playing better again, I guess that's kind of moot. But
it's not a bad thought, though, honestly. I mean,
killed defensively with Jennifer and Broome.
The size would be a huge, huge, huge problem. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I could see Cumberland coming off, and if he's having a rough game, and then Keith Williams getting the rest of his minutes, which I'd be fine with. Keith Williams has played very well this year. But I don't know. The other part of me is just Cumberland's a good shooter. He's never really proven to be a bad one. He's just in a bad slump right now. Just let him shoot his way out of it.
Yeah, definitely. That's the only reason I think him coming off the bench could maybe be good, just because he would probably get more shots off the bench, and, like, just to get his, like, confidence going, because he's, like, way too good a shooter not to play. And, like, even if he came off the bench, he'd still play, like, his normal minutes. I don't think that would change anything. It's like, right, just if Jennifer plays, like, 15 minutes a game, 20 minutes a game. It's like, you definitely need Cumberland's shooting from three.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only reason that he's out there is to drive from the perimeter or hit his threes. And if he's doing neither, then he's not really giving you much else. Kind of like with Kyle Washington, if he's not making his hook shots, if he's not, you know, getting his lobs down low, he's not doing anything else. So, tonight is kind of a throwaway game. I mean, I kind of hate to use the word throwaway game, because, I mean, what if they get upset? But I don't know. I feel like of all the starters, I would leave Cumberland in there the longest, just to have him shoot his way out of the slump. Like, tell him to get 15 shots. Just shoot 15 times and work your way out of it. And if you see, you know, wins the game like 70-50 or 60-40, like some kind of low score, but you brought Cumberland out of his slump heading into Memphis and the rest of the AAC, I mean, mission accomplished.
That's not a bad little strategy. But Cleveland State's offense is 324th in the nation. Like, they're They're really bad at pretty much everything. Like, their turnover percentage is obscenely high. They turn it over like over 20% of the time. They only get 21% on the offensive glass. They never go to the free throw line, and they can't shoot threes or free throws. They're like one of the worst, like almost the worst free throw shooting team in the nation. They're somehow shooting 58.7% on free throws, which is insane. Insane. So this should be a game where UC just gets up big and dominates, and like they're able to mix around it, like get Cumberland some big minutes.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of like the last like scrimmage, but before AAC play, I would hope they figure out all the kinks before then. It seems like they did for the most part against UCLA, which was great to see. I mean, like you said, Kane Broome coming off the bench and exploding in that game, you know, proved that that was the right move. That was the way to go. You're still weaker at the point guard position, but at least you figured out how to use Jennifer and Broom in the same game, as opposed to just basically trying them both out at point guard from the start and just figuring out what works. I mean, now they finally did that, but now they just have to figure out the Cumberland issue, and this is really like the last time to do it. I mean, Memphis isn't the best opponent, but you've got Temple at Temple the following Thursday at 9 goddamn PM, and then or then you have SMU at home. So if you want to go 3-0 in that stretch, you're going to need a good Cumberland. Or at the very worst, not a bad Cumberland. And he's been very bad.
Yeah, definitely. Like, so when he just like can add some offense, like he did against UCLA, hitting a couple of threes, like his passing is good enough to like really propel the offense. Like when he's like dialed in, he's really good. But he's just been kind of wishy-washy, which has been kind of frustrating. One last note on Cleveland State: the best team they played this year by the KenPom rankings is Rutgers. And
Oof.
they scored 38 points against Rutgers. So it seems like UC's biggest opponent tonight is probably going to be boredom.
Yes, boredom. Yeah, boredom in themselves. That's pretty. I mean, the goal of this game: continue working at your kinks. Get Cumberland right in the head.
Don't get
Don't come away
injured.
injured. Don't get injured. And doesn't really matter what the scoreboard says as long as UC has more points. Because that's really the only thing you can do there. Otherwise, we should be set heading into AAC play, 11-2. You probably would have liked it to be a little better than that. I think I would have liked it to be, 12-1 with, having beaten Xavier or Florida, but is what it is. They're still ranked, and it's going to be a freaking dogfight in the AAC with Wichita State, SMU, and potentially Houston. It's going to be a fun conference slate. A lot of those games come late, but it's going to be pretty interesting down the stretch.
Yeah, absolutely. And getting like Temple and SMU like early in the year will be like a nice little kickstart to the league before it like downturns until like February.
Exactly. So, that's all I have, Scott. Do you have anything else you want to touch on?
No, that's it for me. Just besides wishing everybody like a happy holiday season. And we'll try to come back next week. We'll do a year in review show next week if we can schedule a podcast.
Yep, if not, we can figure something out for the first week of January. We'll be back at some point, we promise.
And now I made us have to do a year in review show, so we'll definitely do one now.
And that's it, we're locked in.